Hello, and welcome to episode 130 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with J.J. Prescott and Wayne Logan about their book, Sex Offender Registration and Community Notification Laws, An Empirical Evaluation. Wayne A. Logan is the Stephen M. Goldstein Professor of Law at Florida State University. He's an elected member of the American Law Institute and a past chair of the Criminal Justice Section of the Association of American Law Schools. J.J. Prescott is a Henry King Ransom Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. Prescott publishes broadly on criminal justice issues, employment law, and civil litigation, often using empirical tools and data to inform controversial policy debates. Prescott co-directs the Empirical Legal Studies Center and the Program in Law and Economics at the University of Michigan. Together, they compiled and edited the book, Sex Offender Registration and Community Notification Laws, An Empirical Evaluation, which we will be discussing today. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Wayne and JJ.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I always ask the same first question, and since there's two of you, you'll get two chances to answer it, but it's how did both of you get from wherever you started in life to where you were doing research and writing a book about sex offender registration and notification laws? And I realize that's a very broad and open-ended question, but I like everyone to get to know our guests. So either one of you can start.
Well, I'll let Wayne, I think Wayne, when I started working in this field, he was already a giant. So I'd love to hear.
Yeah, right.
I'd love to hear his intro.
All righty. So thank you, JJ. So I don't know if you want my professional life, but it was pretty typical of a law professor. I went to law school and then clerked for judges and then practiced law for a while. And then I found that I was doing a part-time teaching job while practicing. I found I really liked teaching law school. And so I got into the law teaching racket. This is my 25th year. And so I actually started my initial interest really just after I started teaching and writing papers, 1997. And it just caught my eye, the issue of sex offender registration and community notification. It hadn't been litigated before the U.S. Supreme Court yet. The legal issues were, you know, being decided by lower state and federal courts. There's really a lot of ripe issues still, but it struck me as, you know, one of the major civil liberties issues of our time, and kind of a cornerstone in contemporary efforts to extend the carceral state, so to speak, outside prison walls. So that was what initially interested me, and I've continued to research and write about it for all these years.
How about you, JJ?
Yeah, maybe it's not too different, although when I showed up, there was a lot more work and there had been a lot more litigation in this space already. But I came to registration notification laws as initially sort of excited by the idea of something new in the criminal law. So, you know, as a criminal law teacher, there's a lot that stays the same. And for a long time, the primary way we've tried to control and punish has been through incarceration and occasionally through fines. And suddenly, there is this idea that we can use information and perhaps deputizing the public in certain instances to try to improve public safety. And to me, that was an exciting idea. In the time since then, I've come to realize that it is really more in the direction that Wayne described it, that, you know, this is kind of a growth of the carceral state and the fact that technology and information can be used in a way that essentially lowers the cost of social control is something that we ought to be very worried about and pay particular attention to. But in any event, at the time I started researching in this area, it seemed that economists had not yet gotten to these sets of questions and the data and the laws and litigation existed to try to do something really rigorous to understand the impacts of these laws on criminal behavior. And so I dove in at that point and spent a lot of time trying to get a handle on what these laws look like from state to state.
And, you know, I never like to be accused of burying the lead. So I'm going to start with this, you know, given the data, a lot of what we seem to be facing and sort of an underlying premise in the book, I think, is this notion that a lot of our responses ultimately have a lot more to do with emotion than data or logic. How do you both approach your part of this work, given how committed people and legislators seem to be to kind of emotion and punishment and not really as concerned with the data necessarily, if that's a fair claim, which it may not be?
So I'll go again first. One of the unique things about SORN, which is short for Sex Offender Registration Notification, is that for roughly for a decade, no one really looked at it empirically, analytically. And it just struck me as a real outlier, because a government program or programs of its size not to have been assessed struck me as kind of unusual. And gradually over time, in other words, it was accepted as an article of faith that these laws worked, which troubled me just as a matter of principle. But over time, there's been evidence accumulated, and JJ has contributed mightily to that body of research, looking at various aspects of the law. And what we tried to do in this volume was really, in a kind of concise way, in an accessible way, kind of put together research from really the leading researchers in these particular areas with the 8 or so chapters in the book, that really just try to lay it out, not be advocates, but just try to be as objective as possible and provide the information for policymakers to consider about. Hopefully they'll consider when they're thinking about the laws and whether to tweak them, whether to retain them, et cetera. So that's kind of where I was coming from when we were thinking about putting together the book.
And JJ, do you also just look at it as an objective thing that you're trying to do, or ultimately down the road, do you think that that's something that researchers have to come to grips with, or is it just something that's just going to have to play out the way it plays out?
I mean, it's a great question. I've tended to try to stay in my lane with my research. I mean, the outcomes I've been particularly interested in, although there are plenty of others that policymakers ought to care about, has just been the effects of these laws on recidivism and crime generally. And my thinking from the perspective of like, what would legislators care about, is that at the end of the day, these laws are expensive. They there are a lot of opportunity costs that come with trying to enforce them and keeping people on these lists. And if they really don't make the public safer, then that struck me as the type of argument that legislators, even those who are particularly interested in punishment, and who care less about maybe the individuals who are affected by these laws, would care about. In other words, if it turned out that these laws actually didn't make things any safer, or maybe even made things less safe, that might be the sort of move that would affect the votes on these kinds of laws. A lot of times I feel like people in this space focus on, for example, the rights of registrants, the dignity of registrants, and all of those things are important to me as a potential voter, but I think they are unimportant to many people who are making decisions on these questions. And public safety at the end of the day is the real issue. You've raised another question, which is, well, maybe actually public safety, doesn't matter as much as I thought. That if you actually said, well, if you want to punish people in a certain way, it's actually going to make the world less safe. You are more likely to be the victim of a criminal offense if you decide the way to go is to punish people to this extent. I'm sure there are people in that category, but in trying to target my research towards what I thought would be most likely to move the needle in a direction I thought was positive, right? Whichever way that happened to be, whichever way the work came out, the focus for me was on criminal behavior, because that's really at least what these laws are supposed to be about.
So this question's for JJ. Right now, we seem to be at a place where people are kind of, not just in this area, but in all areas, very skeptical of science and research, almost to the point where they'll accept anecdotal data, often in play, prefer anecdotal data to actual, good data sets, et cetera. Often you'll hear people say things like, well, you can make a study conclude anything. I've had this conversation with relatives. Would you all like to talk about kind of the existential things that you all face as kind of data-based researchers right now? It seems like this is a, maybe not specific to this book, but something specific to the kind of work you do.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in on that one first, Wayne. Yeah, so I mean, this kind of question terrifies me because it's sort of a question that suggests that for some people, facts just don't matter. And I mean, I think that the best response is generally maybe in the same way that I used to answer people who would complain that there are too many lawyers in the world. And I would say, well, there are not enough good lawyers in the world. And I would say the same about empirical research. Well, you can come up with ways to manipulate arguments, even with numbers, that we have an entire set of institutions designed to root out and stop those kinds of manipulations from happening at universities and through the tenure process and through the peer review process as well. And so I think a good, careful reader ought to be careful about any individual study, which is one of the reasons why, you know, Wayne and I went into the direction of, like, let's not focus on a single paper here. What we ought to be focusing on is the large corpus and the broad group of researchers who've basically all, you know, taking many different types of methods, many different approaches, have come to very similar stories and what they see out there. And for me, that's the answer. The answer is we have a lot of checks and balances built in to what makes it through and continues to make it through and to become part of the canon of what we consider to be, you know, quality research.
And Wayne, you know, JJ's talking about, you know, there are a bunch of standards and you can determine between good and bad research. And obviously that's the way I approach things. You know, I had luckily had some scope and methods classes and things like that. But how would you communicate to kind of normal folks, you know, how they can find or how they can identify what is good research?
Well, that's kind of outside my wheelhouse. I'm a law and policy guy, but I would just kind of follow up on what JJ was saying earlier is that I think the book comes to us at a really important time because, as you say, unfortunately, policy has been resistant to facts of late, dogmatically so. And actually, that's consistent with what's happened with criminal justice policy more generally. There's been kind of a disregard or disavowal of experts, quote unquote. And with respect to this particular policy intervention, SORN, you'll see folks saying, like, of course it works. Intuitively, it has to work. And by the way, if only one child is saved, I'm all for this. And so when you have that kind of a mentality with respect to the laws, it makes them very difficult to tweak or change. And combined with that, many of the laws, of course, are named after individual victims. And so, you know, any politician who wants to, you know, be critical of the laws runs the risk of, you know, not just being, you know, pro-sex offender, but also anti this victim. So what we have here is we try to position the book to provide the best research we think is out there on these particular aspects of SORN, and let policymakers and judges and lawyers and citizens make the decision about whether this is a good way to spend our resources, or in fact, whether it's perversely criminogenic, that it may actually be causing greater recidivism among sex offenders, which of course we can talk about later if you want.
Yeah, can I just jump
go ahead.
In?
Sure.
I want to stress that I think one of the aspects of this particular debate that is maybe it's not super uncommon, but here I think the common sense first reaction, as Wayne mentioned, is, well, these laws got to work. Like, how could they make things worse, right? Maybe they don't work super well, but they got to actually make a difference. Having somebody's name on a list, it's got to make it easier to find them. And letting people in their neighborhood know who they are has got to mean that at least a few people will be watching. And you know, even I came to this set of laws in that kind of mindset, that the common sense reaction here seems to be like, how could it make things worse? And I think a simple conversation, well, I won't say a simple, but a conversation where we start to bring in, for example, reentry ideas, that when people return from prison, for example, one of the things we try to do is to get them to reinvest in life, to give them opportunities to improve their ability at leaving that life behind them. And then to point out that these laws really seem to be doing the opposite of that. And so to the extent you believe that there are ways to reduce recidivism with respect to other crimes, it's worth noting that we're not doing that. We're actually doing the opposite when it comes to people who have been convicted of sex crimes. And that kind of dynamic approach that that making life tough for people through monitoring and lots of procedural burdens and so on has real documented consequences in every other domain where we look at this sort of thing. And so there is actually a tension here, an empirical question when you wind up thinking about it. Maybe this helps a little bit, but does it help enough to compensate for all the potential consequences of these laws in terms of well-known risk factors for returning to crime?
And I think also just another thing, point to emphasize is that it's really kind of a zero-sum game, because every dollar that's spent on SORN is a dollar that's not being spent on perhaps more efficacious interventions. And if that's the case, that's something that public policy makers should keep in mind when they're looking at how to best try to ensure public safety. One other thing I would add too is that just the uniqueness of these laws. So as many listeners might be aware, in addition to SORN, there are residence exclusion zones in many states and many, many more localities. And basically those residence exclusion laws piggyback on SORN, or at least a registered status. And so, and the idea there is that a registrant will, if they're going to recidivate, they're going to, particularly if they're going to focus on children, they'll do it in their neighborhood. So these laws prohibit registrants from living within 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet of a school, a playground, or what have you. What people don't really realize is that in addition to having very, very questionable efficacy, is that they're at cross purposes with registration. Because if an individual is not going to be able to live with his mother or wherever it is because it's within 1,000 feet of the school, they're going to be less likely to be candid about where they're living. And that, of course, is the premise of registration, that police officers and members of the public know where individuals live. So this is another example of how unique these laws are, that people are just so wedded and determined to essentially focus on this subpopulation that sometimes it's incoherent and the policies can be at cross purposes. And so we focus on that as well in the book too, the residence exclusion zones, which again is another important feature of the public policy here.
Strangely enough, one of the things we actually got rid of in the last SORN update here in Michigan, as a directly impacted person, when people ask me or when I'm speaking about this, I'll usually say that the whole thing started, and I'm sure that everybody had the best of intentions. We're trying to be as logical as possible. And there may have been definitely were unintended consequences. Wayne, I know your chapter kind of explains this. How did we kind of get from where this all started to where we are today? Can you kind of give a brief tour and maybe an understanding of the history of kind of registration laws for people who don't know, who might be listening?
Sure, happy to do that. So, historically, governments have tried to track individuals who have been convicted of crimes. So originally, of course, it was mutilation and bodily marking, photographs, when that came into technological wherewithal in late 19th century. In the 1930s in the United States, several localities in Southern California got the idea that they would require folks who came in, coming into town or living in town to register. And this was of a broad realm of offenses. And they were mainly concerned about so-called gangsters infiltrating their towns because of increased access to transportation through trains and buses and whatnot, and kind of anonymously living in their midst. So the original laws in 1930s were by local governments, and they were, again, very broad. They didn't focus on sex offenders explicitly. In 1947, California had the first statewide law, and that law did focus on sex offenders. And it's instructive to go back and look at the history of that law when Governor Earl Warren was governor of California. And there was a lot of pushback and a lot of people were concerned that, we shouldn't require people to register because they paid their debt to society and they should be reintegrated and continue their lives. But that became law. And then slowly thereafter in the late 40s, 50s, 60s, a couple of states had registration laws. A couple of them focused exclusively on sex offenders, some of them on people with drug offenses. But the laws really didn't really have much interest and they weren't really enforced very regularly or aggressively by police. Well, in 1989, a boy in the state of Washington was sexually assaulted, mutilated by a fellow who was just let out of prison. And the police knew that this fellow was in the community. They were worried about him. And when it became publicly known that the police knew about this fellow's whereabouts and that he was the suspect for the victimization of this boy, people were very, very upset. They felt betrayed by their government. And they basically said, we have a right to know. So in Washington in 1990, they enacted a new a registration law, but they also introduced something called community notification. And so for the first time in 1990, information on registrants was made publicly available. At that point, it was a pretty modest amount of information and a modest slice of individuals who had been released from prison. But like wildfire, over the next couple of years, every state gravitated to registration and community notification laws, in significant part because the federal government threatened the states with the loss of criminal justice funding if they didn't get registration laws and then also community notification laws. So by the late 1990s, every state in the union had a registration and community notification laws. So it's an interesting arc how they came into existence, relatively modest state early on, went into a period of lack of attention or use, and then really just, as I said, like wildfire, things exploded in the 1990s. At the same time, actually, in that very same law from Washington, Washington enacted a new generation commitment law, which entailed involuntary commitment, potentially indefinitely, of individuals who are convicted of sex offenses, so-called Sexually Violent Predator Act. So that happened at that very same time in 1990 with that same legislation with community notification. So that's kind of a back of the envelope history. Hope it was helpful.
Yeah. And is there any, do you have any knowledge on how people arrived at the particulars of these laws, like the many requirements? Was there data contributing to this, or is this just like people's best guess of how you get to a safer society through these laws? Was, you know, I've asked this question of sentencing experts before, and I say, was there any actual, you know, is sentencing literally just made up, you know? And most of the time they say yes. So I wonder if you have any insight.
Well, this was, and again, as I said, it remained so for many, many years until empiricists started looking at it critically. But yeah, the first law basically said, hey, let's rejuvenate registration. Let's adopt that. That makes sense. So the police can know where they are. But, you know, we have a right to know. We have an informational entitlement, was basically where people were coming from in the state of Washington. They were outraged that the government had this information on this man and they didn't share it, let alone that he was let out in the community. Right. So at the beginning, it was this visceral reaction to being betrayed, and that they had an entitlement to this information. And with that information, they would be able to take proactive measures to keep themselves and their family and loved ones safe. That was the basic idea. And that's the model that, continued on through the 1990s and to this day, frankly. And, you know, one of the chapters in the books looks at, by Professor Lisa Sample from the University of Nebraska, looks at, you know, whether people look at websites these days, and those that do, whether they actually take proactive measures. And there's not a lot of strong evidence for either of those research questions.
JJ, most of the middle chapters are about costs and opportunity costs of registration. And I think Wayne mentioned a few minutes ago that a lot of this stuff is zero sum. One potential opportunity cost, it seems apparent to me that sex crimes are solved at very low rates, at least this the data I've seen, and the registration at least uses a decent amount of law enforcement resources. If law enforcement is focused on people who are registered, and most new sex crimes are committed by first-time offenders, which is data I've seen as well, it seems to reason that this is potentially an opportunity cost. Is that fair?
I think so. I think, I think one of the you know, real downsides of the SORN legislation is that it has really shifted everybody's gaze to people who have been convicted of a sex offense at some prior point, and has led policymakers to stop focusing on preventing first time offenders. And you're right about the evidence. The evidence suggests, and Kelly Socha and others have looked at criminal records over time. And if you just look at who's committing offenses, who's being arrested for these offenses, who's being convicted of these offenses, it's on the order of 90 or above percent are people with no record of a prior offense, which means they would not be in or on a registry or being subject to community notification. So we spent a lot of time on these 10% of offenses, trying to figure out how to reduce them. And I think one of the things you realize is that even if this is like the most effective way of reducing recidivism ever, which we now know it's not, the real room for making a big difference is very small. I mean, you know, even if you reduced recidivism rates by 50%, you'd still have 19 out of 20 sex offenses occurring in this country, at least according to these criminal record studies. So I think we're spending a lot of time focusing on people who have past convictions, and for whatever reason, that's not where the action is or where our focus ought to be.
Another of the kind of opportunity costs that's mentioned by Kelly Socia, actually, she said another fiscal consideration. Another fiscal consideration is the impact of SORN on other potential strategies that might be effective in reducing sexual offending. Every dollar spent retooling registry systems, purchasing hardware and software, or hiring personnel to maintain SORN systems is a dollar that cannot be dedicated to substance abuse or mental health treatment, educational resources, parole and probation services, or similar measures. So it seems, even if you believed within what you were just talking about, if this was somehow a perfect recidivism kind of area or machine, that it would also have, it also might be ineffectively using resources within even that set. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think even if there were some evidence to suggest that these policies made a positive difference, an important question would be, well, how positive is it relative to other programs that we could be pursuing? And I think the general consensus here is that these policies are quite expensive relative to most other potential solutions to recidivism.
Now, Jill Levinson also suggests another possible opportunity cost. She says she talks about the cost of over-inclusive registries, which were, as she puts it, I know she's a she because I've met her, might actually interfere with law enforcement's ability to monitor those at great risk to reoffend, and presuming strangers need to be protected against, it dilutes the public's ability to identify truly dangerous individuals. Could either of you talk about kind of this inefficiency in registration schemes?
Sure, I guess start the ball rolling. So, I mean, one of the concerns about registration, of course, is that it creates a false sense of security. And JJ just alluded to that, because the majority of offenders are first-time offenders, so they're not captured by the registry. So if you are availing yourself of the information on the registry, you know, I'm gonna have to worry about John Smith, who's two doors down. Well, you know, you'd be ill-advised to do that exclusively, right? Because again, what we know about offending is that people will be the first timers, right? And also, of course, it's among familiars, particularly with children. And so it kind of, in a way, perversely discourages parents from taking more kind of active roles in educating their children, trying to keep their children safe, because they all have to do is worry about John Smith, you know, down the street. And so, you know, the other issue too, of course, is that, you know, people, as I said earlier, they're not availing themselves of the registry. So what are we left with? What's happened over time, of course, initially in Washington, it was a very hands-on. So only the most serious registrants, level three, were the community told about. And it was done with community meetings. Now it's done by the internet. And of course, which is indelible, even if a person somehow gets off a registry, whatever the jurisdiction might be, that information very well will continue on out there. But it almost kind of is a Band-Aid where, you know, we're kind of going through the motions, and it's kind of, you know, performative is one phrase that's been used to, right? So, yeah, we have SORN here. We're going to put all these folks up on the registry, and we're doing our part. And I think it's kind of troubling that to the extent it's an offloading by law enforcement to the public to kind of self-secure themselves, it's not a very good method of doing that. We know that because folks don't avail themselves of the registry. So there's a whole cluster of issues here with respect to whether, you know, the scope of the registry is too broad, because as one of the Supreme Court's justices said in another context, you know, when everything is classified, nothing is classified. And so if you've got a bloated registry, you know, not only do we have a problem with respect to ignoring the first offender, right, but we also have, if it's undifferentiated, you know, Florida, for instance, that's basically everybody who's a sex offender or a sexual violent predator, they're on the list. They're on there indefinitely, lifetime, right? And there's no gradations with respect to any individualized risk. So, you know, what we're expecting is hypervigilance from community members for the lifetime of these individuals on the internet. And that's not realistic. It's not realistic.
So another thing that I think for many of us that Levinson's argument raises is this notion that there could be a more effective registry or a safer registry, or registry that produces public safety. I think a lot of us on my side of things tend to question that. And some of the things we've already discussed seem to suggest that while you might be able to tinker and make a registry a better registry, it doesn't necessarily mean that you would produce public safety. Do you all have kind of thoughts on the policy end of what we should be looking for as an outcome based on the data you all have read?
Well, just say initially, I'll defer to JJ, but I mean, for one thing, to have individualized risk assessments, they're more expensive on the front end because you have to dedicate the resources to evaluating people individually, as opposed to a one size fits all, such as in Florida and many other states, right, where everybody's on the registry undifferentiated. One other thing that is happening lately, a very significant event we should mention here in our time together, is that the American Law Institute, which is, you know, kind of an August institution, they've been around for many, many decades, and they're in charge of restatements of torts and contracts and property. But they also recently have overhauled the model penal code, and they paid some attention to SORN in it. And very significantly, the membership said that we are going to no longer require community notification. We're only going to have registration, and we're going to have it for a much more circumscribed population. And so the registry will only be accessible by law enforcement, which is the way it was in the 1930s up through 1990. So that's a very significant development. And of course, it's just an advisory body, but it's a significant event because the American Law Institute is a major organization with respect to law and policy.
Yeah, in fact, you know, in several public discussions on this, I've actually supported a lot of the innovations that they suggested. But I think, and JJ, you might want to talk about this too, would, based on what we've seen, and I know in at least one set of your data what the answer probably is going to be to this, is it possible to have a registry scheme that is more likely than not to create public safety, I guess is the best way I could put that.
I mean, I really think it's a hypothetical. I mean, I don't think we've seen such a system yet, but if somebody asks you straight up, is it possible to construct an effective registry if you have infinite money and infinite focus on the right kind of considerations? It seems to me that the answer has to be, yeah. Like I imagine there could be a set of people who have certain records who science and evidence suggest to us that they are likely to recidivate, and at such a level that it would make sense at least to make sure law enforcement is aware of them, and maybe even neighbors under certain circumstances. But to be honest, whether or not there's a practical scheme, I'm pretty skeptical of something like that happening. So, I mean, I think it's theoretically possible, but there's always going to be difficulties with classifying people given the kinds of tools we have, and the type of registry, like I'm imagining, would be, you know, so different and so much smaller in scale that it would sort of be hard to describe it as the same type of tool that we see being deployed today. But I do think this is a hypothetical, and when somebody says it's something possible, I tend to think, well, you know, theoretically, it's possible, but practically speaking, I think it would be extremely difficult for us to find the right balance to make what you're describing happen.
I think, you know, both of you have mentioned the chapter by Lisa Sample and her suggestion that while registration schemes are incredibly popular, in practically almost nobody actually uses them. which sort of suggests that the costs are not balanced by the benefits, even if registries could be applied more effectively. What do you all think about this part of the data?
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, there's a lot of results suggesting that people really, in the end, really don't care that much if it, quote unquote, works, which kind of leaves us basically with what do we have? It's stigmatization. And that's okay because this subpopulation deserves to be stigmatized. But I think the next question that you can't obviously argue against that if someone feels that way, but the next, I think, response needs to be, well, let's look at the data. Is this actually delivering public safety? And that's kind of where we started this conversation. That's why we put together this book, because we want people to look under hood and think about this. Because again, there are trade-offs being made here. You know, not only may SORN be problematic in itself, but it's coming at a cost of other interventions possibly.
And I'll just say, I think there is an important set of psychological issues that have to do with the use of information as a tool, as a form of regulation. There was some work done years back by Molly Wilson that talked about registries in general, not registries that focused on people who were convicted of sex offenses. And she comes at it from a psychological perspective and kind of ropes in thoughts that many of us have had about TSA and this idea that if we know about something, for some reason, we feel like we're in more in control. And practically speaking, that's a cognitive bias or behavioral bias that oftentimes leads us in the wrong direction. And I think that's really on display when it comes to SORN laws. Sometimes knowing things doesn't make us any safer, and in fact leads to all sorts of other negative consequences. And I think it's really hard for people to imagine this idea that sometimes it would be better for everybody if certain things were not known, that if certain information wasn't out there. But that seems to be one of the drivers of registries, that pretty much without any evidence, people naturally assume that if I know something, if I'm aware of something, that I feel psychologically more comfortable with the situation when I'm facing risk, because I feel like I can do something about it. And I think that links back, Josh, to what you were saying before about the people like registries, even though they don't use them. And even if they go on to use them, they don't use them in the way you would think somebody who was really nervous about becoming a victim. Instead, it's a source of gossip or maybe even persecution of people on the list, but very few people actually change or engage in what seems likely to be effective, protective, self-protective behavior. And that may make sense if we think that really what I love is that I can look somebody up, or I know that it's there in case I ever need it. And you know what, that makes me feel good. And I think a lot of times that kind of behavioral drive is counterproductive, both at the individual and the societal level.
And to kind of speak to how that plays out, your chapter with Amanda Agin, JJ, starts with a pretty strong summary paragraph. A coherent story emerges from this review. There is virtually no evidence that SORN laws reduce recidivism or otherwise increase public safety. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, there have now been dozens of researchers who, like me, got interested in these new tools that that began, that have a long history, but really came back to the fore in the early 90s. And they through state level criminal records data or national level federal criminal reporting data, many different strategies, that all of which the hope has been when you're going out, when you're testing something against the null, to look for some effect of these laws, to identify some reduction either in overall frequency of sex offenses or in a reduction in recidivism. And really, there's only one paper that we discuss in the chapter that has found anything reliably in the direction that maybe there's some benefit here. And that's an older paper by Du and Dene that finds a very targeted notification regime in Minnesota that that, you know, that that looked at risk levels and applied to very few people, that it may have had positive effects on reducing recidivism. But given how many papers have actually been written, how much data has been analyzed, it would actually be, it's actually somewhat surprising that there aren't more papers that randomly have found some positive outcomes that come from these laws. So so I think that, I mean, you really can't find somebody who studies these laws, who focuses on this social problem, who believes that these laws are effective. At least notification, private registration, I think the consensus is very nearly the same. However, I think we know a lot less about how those systems might work just because there was just kind of a blip in time when we had them in the early 90s. And we went pretty quickly to a combined scheme where both law enforcement and the public was made aware of people who had past convictions.
And some people might say, okay, it might be true that registration laws don't prevent recidivism, but they probably serve as a deterrent. And I know you wrote about this a little bit in that article. Is that the case? Or at least, is the deterrent impact significant enough to justify the human cost, potential criminogenic impacts, and opportunity costs of enforcement of the regime?
Yeah, great. So in my work with Jonah Rockoff, we do find that that a notification regime, sort of a typical one, has some deterrent payoff. And I think that's maybe not surprising, that the idea that you would be listed publicly and known publicly as a sex offender might cause you at the margin to behave differently. However, our research also shows that unless you're at a really small scale, in other words, unless people are really deterred and never actually commit crimes, that the trade-off doesn't work out in favor of these laws. In other words, that any deterrence benefit is swamped in our research by recidivism enhancing consequences that come from the criminogenic risk factors that are exacerbated by these laws. So pretty much every state at the scale it operates now, the any deterrence gains are completely swamped by recidivism increases that come from risk factors. Now, this I think is a broader problem that we have to think about when we're thinking about punishment generally, which is, you know, one nice thing about really severe, terrible punishments is that they're likely to deter. On the other hand, if they don't really work well, you actually have to impose these incredibly costly and damaging punishments on people. And I think this is an example of that. Even though there seems to be some modest improvement in terms of potential first-time offenders deciding not to commit these crimes, the consequences are that you have a lot of other people who, you know, commit these crimes, they're not deterred, and then they're made potentially more dangerous as a result of these laws. So hopefully that came across pretty clearly, but I don't think that that notification can really be thought about as just a deterrent strategy, because in order to have it work as a deterrent strategy, it also brings along all of these risk factors for recidivism after the fact, and it's really impossible to separate those two things.
And a little earlier, Wayne, you raised the ALI model statute. And I, for at least the last 8 years, have argued that for what I've called presumptive graduation over a period of time, kind of like the clean slate concept, if you stay clean for a certain amount of time, you presumptively graduate. Because even if you believe that registries work, the more people registered, the harder it becomes to make the registry useful, which is something that JJ was just talking about in terms of deterrence as well. Do you have any thoughts about that or that part of the ALI?
Yeah, that's an important feature of the new provision, which is to say that people after a period of time, 10 years or so, can basically prove their fit. And if they don't have any other offenses, they can be left off the registry. And that's important. Many jurisdictions have some opportunity to get off or exit, so to speak, but they can make it quite difficult for individuals. And in Florida, it's darn near impossible to get off. One other thing we haven't talked about yet, but I think merits some particular attention, is registration of juveniles, which a chapter in the book addresses that Professor Letourneau, Johns Hopkins, so provides a wonderful chapter. And that, you know, really has remains a very controversial issue. So here we're not talking about juvenile offenders who were prosecuted and convicted as adults. We're talking about juveniles who were adjudicated delinquent. Under federal law and under many states, juveniles are required to register. And we're talking about 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, et cetera. And Professor Letourneau, I think, quite nicely captures the difficulties that are presented in that particular subpopulation. Obviously, a difficult phase in one's life, and to be tarred early on indefinitely, very often is seemingly counterproductive. And aside from, you know, perhaps being just improper in principle. So that's an important issue too. And I should say, I mentioned a moment ago when I kind of gave the broad history, when the federal government came in and basically said, states, we need you to do registration and notification. One of the features more recently was that we want you to register juveniles. And many states said, no, we're just not doing that. And so they actually decided to say, we'll do without the money, the federal grant money, because they were so principally opposed to it. So that's another important aspect of this whole debate about how to deal with these youngsters who, you know, have been adjudicated, you know, delinquent with respect to sex offenses. But again, you know, many jurisdictions do allow it.
So I think for most people in the general public, the way that they actually hear about the registry the most, and the reason, one of the reasons I think they think it's effective, is because they see failure to register sweeps. They see stories about failure to register sweeps. But most of the evidence I've seen suggests that failure to register, or failure to register correctly, is rarely a marker for new crime. And so what people are seeing is people swept up essentially for what we would call in parole and probation technical violations. Is that fair, JJ?
Yeah, that's fair. I think that these, to stay in compliance is difficult. It's burdensome, and people make mistakes. And although this is changing in a few places, mistakes oftentimes don't protect you from being found guilty of a failure to register crime. I think the research on this suggests that failure to register is more an indicator of general generally disorganized life, and so it doesn't seem to be linked, according to the data, to an increased proclivity to engaging in sex offenses. More generally, it seems to be that you're more likely to fail to register again if you failed to register in the past. And where there have been correlations between being convicted of a failure to register crime, the correlation is to crime generally. So it's a sign that somebody is in trouble socioeconomically, they're unemployed, they're having trouble making ends meet, they have other issues going on, mental health or otherwise, and so failure to register is actually a general sign that they might need more help, not that they are, you know, engaged in sex offenses.
And related to that too, if I might add, Joshua, so homelessness is a real problem for people who have been convicted of sex offenses. And it's obviously aggravated when you're on the registry. So there's a rather significant homeless population. And of course, again, also additionally aggravated by residence exclusion laws, which, you know, place limits on where people can live. So JJ made mention of this kind of disorganized, disordered lives. Well, for these folks where they have to list that, you know, I live behind the Shell station in the woods behind a dumpster, and they can be pushed away from that. And if they don't inform the police of their new location, that's an FTR, it's a failure to register. So, you know, again, it's an issue of the laws working across purposes. If we want these folks to be living lives that'll be conducive to positive reentry, have stable housing, stable work, stable social relationships, you know, access to counseling and whatnot, we're not acting in that way to try to achieve that result. And the failure to register data kind of reflects that one aspect of that problem, particularly with respect to homeless individuals.
JJ, I know this is a little bit beyond the scope of any research that's in this book, but I know I've talked to you before There's two things that have happened in Michigan that I think are interesting and probably, although it might be hard to study them, are probably worth studying. The first one is that because of a federal court judge, Michigan actually functionally didn't have a registry for about a year. No one had to register. Over a year. And the second is that last year, we essentially got rid of the distance requirements and the school zones. And I know there's other states that have that too, but we kind of are a before and after, I would assume, eventually. And so I was just wondering, I know you've said this would be very hard to research, but I'm wondering if you've had any other thoughts. The last time you explained to me why it was hard to research, even though I've had scope and methods and a few other things, my head spun for about 3, 4, 5 minutes. So I'm going to try again. Are there any hopes of us?
Sure. Yeah, I actually think that the fact that the new SORN law in Michigan remove some of these residency restrictions and others, that's a stark change required by a court. It's unlikely to be correlated with other trends in sex offenses or other crimes. And it strikes me as a great natural experiment. I mean, it'd be even better if it happened at random times in other states, or it was implemented in some way, it was rolled out at different times. But I think that there is it's sort of an obvious place to do some work and to look at how people who either coming out of prison or coming off of a recent conviction, where they decide to live, where crimes that do occur wind up being relative to the places that, you know, used to be off limits. And my guess is that we're not going to see much of a change, and that's going to be precisely because these residency restrictions didn't accomplish very much, given what we know about how people travel to commit crimes and so on. But that I think would be the goal. The goal would be to show that really there was no spike in crime or no change in crime, and that's sometimes hard because you ideally are looking for a rejection of the null to see some change here, and here we're actually looking for the opposite. We're looking to show that removing a policy, really that policy made no difference because nothing new is going on. People are behaving just as they were before. And I think that the one difference there is, or one way we could look for real improvement in the lives of people who were formerly bound by these things would be to look at how they disperse and change where they live to make it easier for their kids to go to school and so on. The other experiment where the registry was turned off for a year, a lot of that, from my perspective, depends on how people thought of or were aware of that treatment. So if it went from on to off, and people thought and people were aware that the registry was no longer a thing and it wasn't available, you couldn't find out whether people were on it before as opposed to just not registering new people, then that too would be a nice experiment. But because it was off for a year, and I think that probably by the time people figured it out, it was mostly back on and functioning. It's really unclear what we would learn from it. We might see, as in the other situation, that nothing really changed, which is, again, what we would hope to find. But in that case, I think somebody who wanted to criticize that claim would say, well, this was a temporary thing. People probably didn't realize it. And maybe if we really turned off the registry, we would see big changes in behavior. But when you just have a kind of a temporary short-lived blip where everybody's really kind of unclear what's happening, nobody felt comfortable to really shift their behavior. And so this doesn't convince me, not me, but the person who is critical of any research that shows nothing really changed during that time, might not be convinced by it.
Yeah, I guess the thing that's interesting to me is that the behavior of the people who check the registry wasn't technically off. It's just that the information wasn't being updated.
Old, right? Yeah.
And so almost all the information people were gleaning from the registry was unreliable. And so if the notification scheme is supposed to be helping people navigate so that they reduce the risk to children, whatever, how could that be possible?
I think that like what you're suggesting to me just reminds me how much more we could do here if we collected better data, right? So right now, at least I'm unaware of careful measurement of how people are using the site and, you know, what they're doing on the site and whether or not they are downloading, for example, during this period, outdated information or information that is still technically accurate if just because the person has continued to live in the same place. And we just don't know any of those things. And that's a real shame. It's really not that hard to capture this kind of information. Storage is cheap, plenty of ways that it could be done. And the fact that law enforcement agencies tend to, I guess, miss the opportunity of collecting data that would allow them to show that their policies and their tools are making a big difference speaks volumes to me. It actually suggests, you know, what do you do when you're not sure that your policies are working? Well, you obfuscate, you make it so it's really hard to show that they're not working. And so I think that a lot in all of these types of opportunities for study, so much depends on what data is available. And as you and I have discussed before, actually getting registry data over time and identifying people who were sort of on the registry and joined at a certain time, all of that is basically impossible to do unless you have a court order. And at least in my own experience, like I've had a lot of trouble in states like Michigan and elsewhere trying to get that. The one time I've ever had a history of where people have lived, that information happened to have been saved and stored by the state of Maryland. I used it to study where offenders who were listed on the registry moved and where sex offenses were occurring in that jurisdiction. And it turns out that if you know where a registered sex offender, a registrant lives, the risk of a crime, a sex offense happening near that person is actually lower than it is in other places. In other words, there's really nothing to the common sense, I guess, assumption that if you're closer to a registrant's address, you're at greater risk of a sex offense. That's really what motivates a lot of what we're doing here, or what the legislatures are doing. And yet it turns out to be like factually untrue, at least in Maryland. So
you all both, you know, helped edit and put together this book. If someone is going to, what's the pitch you would give to someone who wanted to read this book? And then each of you, if you could say where you think this is all potentially heading, what you think the next frontier of the fight is, or, you know, what the next thing, you know, that's likely to happen as a result of kind of the data that's come together about sex offense registries, et cetera. And if you would start, Wayne.
Sure. Well, again, I kind of go back to where, the ALI, American Law Institute, is on this. I mean, that's a big shift from a major organization. And there are a lot of folks who, you know, advocates who say we should just, you know, the whole thing should be blown up, right? Nothing at all. But I don't think that's realistic at this point. I approach this not as an advocate. I look at it really as from a social science perspective, and was the main purpose of our book. And so our hope here is we'll put this information out again, that people make decisions about it accordingly. And, you know, we don't take particular stands in the book. What we try to do is to be, you know, provide the information that we have, we talk about. So I think that's the next stage, really, is to try to look at the laws critically and perhaps modify them. Again, I tend to be pretty realistic about this, or pessimistic, I guess, depending on perspective, that I don't think SORN laws altogether are going to go away anytime soon. But I hope with, you know, consultation with the research, the changes will be made to make them better. And I think the ALI, American Law Institute's suggestions are a really concrete step in that direction, which is to say, you know, limit the number of people on the registry, and have to be private, so to speak. In other words, only accessible by law enforcement.
Yeah, I still go with that. Graduation to me is kind of the grail of, we might not be able to get rid of registries, but if we can get rid where everybody can theoretically get off of registries, and, you know, in a presumptive manner, I think it ultimately gets us close to the same thing. JJ, did you have thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the really great things about the book is it tries to help somebody who's new to this topic, maybe a judge, maybe an advocate, understand what to many, I think, seems unexpected, that these laws really don't seem to have the effects that a typical person might think they would, and then to understand maybe the underlying mechanism. So, for example, we have Lisa Sample's chapter that explains, well, in order for these things to work, especially notification, you actually have to have people going and using them in a particular way. And if it turns out they're not doing that, then it's not surprising that these things aren't making the kind of difference that a lot of people assume they will. And in fact, I would say that one of the most notable things about SORN laws is they're very fragile, in the sense that they have to have a lot of things go right in order for them to make the kind of impact that their proponents recommend. And this book helps, I think, people understand that from the existing social science. And in terms of where to go next, I'm just going to make a push, which I probably do in almost every talk I give on this, for more data. I mean, I think if we're really serious about making the kinds of targeted changes, we really need to know where there's a possibility of there being a positive role for these laws, and where that's just not likely. And in order to do that, we need to actually dig in to how these laws are working with particular subpopulations and so on. And that's a real a question that that those are questions that are going to be hard to get at without the kind of data that I think we could collect, but we're not collecting, or at least it's not publicly available right now.
So, you know, we were talking earlier about Wayne was talking about being a little bit more pessimistic. I tend to be a little pessimistic myself a lot of the time. Taking off your professor hats, it doesn't even have to be about SORN, but my friend Amanda Alexander always talks about the power of dreaming big and having freedom dreams. So this season, I'm asking folks what dreams they have about changing our system outside of the work you're doing, just kind of general, if you have any dream you could share with us or any thought you could share with us in this area.
Sure. So one of the areas I also research and write in is policing. And of course, that's a big, big issue these days in the wake of George Floyd. And of course, you know, defund the police has been a mantra, but I think people are kind of now reorienting themselves to maybe unpacking the police function. And I'm very optimistic about that. I think that's a very good development. So for instance, people with mental illness, different, you know, autistic disorders and things like that, the police are not equipped to work with those folks when they encounter them in the community. And unfortunately, tragically, a lot of times fatalities spin out of that. So I think one positive development now is kind of, again, disaggregating the police function and saying, well, maybe officers shouldn't respond first, or perhaps people with background and training with mental health should be there with the officers. And so when I teach students, I always say this is a pretty great time to be interested in policy with respect to criminal justice system, because not only are we looking at mass incarceration and policing, you know, the big issues, but people are really getting in the weeds and kind of looking critically at different components about whether they can work better. And in the corrections context, as you know, I'm sure, a lot of it, the interest has been from the conservatives, the Right on Crime group. And of course, their orientation is more, they don't think it's efficient use of tax dollars, et cetera. Whereas progressives are concerned about what they see to be inhumanity and the unfairness of the system. But those two forces coming together, we're looking at the criminal justice system differently. And we're starting to see slow tapering down with respect to incarceration rates. So I think it's a propitious and optimistic time in which we live. And we'll see if some of these things come to full of fruition. But I'm optimistic generally, although I tend to be realistic that reform can be very slow and painstaking. And particularly with SORN, as I said at the outset, there's just a real strong emotive aspect to it that it's hard for people to focus on the data, even if the data is available. And with this book, again, we're trying to make the data available so at least they can have an informed decision about whether it's the right public policy route to pursue.
JJ?
Yeah, as a social scientist, I love the idea of a freedom dream, and it sounds a little weird to say more data is my freedom dream, but
you got to admire your consistency, JJ.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to say that I think we do way too much on the basis of assumptions. And I think that actually we'd be a much safer and freer society if we spent a lot more time with data, and also recognizing that there are going to be times where the data don't tell us the answer to a certain question, and that if we had a sort of a presumption in favor of freedom in those circumstances. In other words, like if we're going to bring, I mean, this is what we teach in the first week or two of criminal law, that if you're actually going to bring the power of the state, whether in terms of incarceration or execution or even putting somebody's name on a registry, that you ought to have a burden of proving that it's actually a good idea, not just that the person is guilty of a crime, but that how we actually move forward makes sense. And I think that that we used to have a lot of trouble doing that, because we would just be, on the one hand, on the other hand, anecdotal stories. How can you think about a burden of proof in that setting when you're evaluating policies? Well, you know what? We now have the ability to do that in a much more serious way. We can actually say, if we're going to use these kinds of punishments or these sorts of treatments, before we do it, we ought to study it, and we ought to have an expectation that that at least, again, it's hard to study policies that are not implemented, but there's oftentimes going to be adjacent policies where we can say, listen, we actually have really good reason to think that this will make the kind of positive difference in society. And without that, I think there should be a pretty strong assumption that we don't move forward. And if people started thinking about criminal justice policy that way, I think we tend to have a lot less of it. And we would use a lot of other social tools, you know, family and religion and other institutions to help guide people to better lives.
I know we're here to talk about your book, but I also like to ask people if there are any criminal justice related books that they like and might recommend to our listeners. Do either of you have any favorite books?
Well, I try to do as much fiction reading as I can in the summer. So one book which I read recently, which I really enjoyed, is Nickel Boys, NICKELBOYS, Nickel Boys by Whitehead. And he actually, the story basically concerns a kind of a reform school for delinquent boys northwest of here in Tallahassee, Florida, which existed for many years, and just tragically so. It was very poorly, inhumanely run. And they've only recently, over the last 15 years, have they found bodies buried there. And so they're trying to unravel that story. But Whitehead's book is wonderful. I highly recommend it. It's called Nickel Boys. It's a great kind of historical fiction account of the Dozier School here in Northwest Florida.
JJ?
I'm gonna start off by pitching Wayne's 2009 book, Knowledge is Power, which I think was, you know, what I would direct people to read if they really want to get into the idea of using registries in general. I think it was important to me when I started working in this area, and I think it's a nice compliment to what we've done. The other book, I mean, I have other books, and one is not too recent, but John Pfaff's Locked In book. It's a data-based argument that really, I think, does a great job at trying to figure out where mass incarceration comes from and what are essentially the ambits of power of prosecutors, and where their voters come from and where the resources come from, and how do we wind up with a system that seems to be incarcerating far too many people. And what I love about the book is that it's specific, it's precise, and it leans on data to make its claim. So I think, and I think it's also the kind of book that a lot of people can read.
I find it surprising that you appreciated another economist book. Well, I mean, in fairness, John was my 50th guest when that book came out, a little after that book came out, and actually someone I've gotten to spend some time with. So I appreciate that one quite a bit. Were there other ones, or was that?
I think two is plenty.
those are good books. So how would you recommend people find y'all's book or your book?
Well, I think it's on Amazon. I can hold a picture I don't know if you have a picture there handy to you, Josh, or I can put it up here. I don't know if it.
I mean, you can put it up there if you want. There it is, it'll be, the people who are on the podcast will see it in the show notes.
Sure. So it's on Amazon. It's also, it's published by Cambridge University Press. So it's also on their website as well.
It's a good question, Josh. I didn't even think that it might be tough to find our book, but maybe it is. I'm not sure. So.
Luckily, I got to read it through a PDF copy. So I always ask the same last question. When I mess up, what question should I have asked but did not? Otherwise known as the humility question.
You did a great job.
Thanks.
I think you did a great job. I think one question I thought we might not get to, but we did in sort of a roundabout way, is just the question of reform versus abolition, whether or not we should go all the way. And I think we've had that conversation. I think that is a space where a lot of people are having conversations right now. And I think ALI's salvo here is I think going to raise a lot of those questions, but I think we did talk about that. So I think you did a great job.
Thank you. Yeah. I try to get a little bit, or at least get an idea of what people's response will be to questions like that through some of the questions I ask. Well, it's really great to have both of you on, and I really enjoyed the book. Obviously, had a personal stake in reading it, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Yeah, thank you very much.
Take care.
And now, my take. I don't do many episodes about the registry because I don't want this podcast to primarily be about issues that impact me directly. But I don't want to act like that makes this Kafkaesque regime okay. Registries do not make our community safer. They do not help ensure that people do not commit new crimes or protect victims. They make our communities more dangerous. They make the people subject to them isolated, lonely, desperate, and give them no hope for a life where they can return to society safely. You may not like hearing that, but it's the truth. Literally mountains of evidence back up what I'm saying. Registries do not prevent new crimes. They do not deter. And the vast majority of people who commit new sex offenses are not on registries. Registries waste law enforcement resources that can be used to investigate and prosecute new sex crimes, and most new sex crimes are never prosecuted. Finally, even if you refuse to believe what I'm saying, despite the mountains of evidence, if you are so committed to punishment over reason that you will ignore all of this, you should support presumptive graduation from registries, because if they are effective, the more the registry is packed, the less effective it is at creating public safety. And if you reject all of this, you are in essence suggesting that you would rather create the situations likely to allow more sex crimes, make your communities less safe, and make law enforcement less effective at prosecuting actual sex crimes. Because that's actually exactly what registration accomplishes. People who care about the safety of their community should actively oppose registries. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes, or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, and Espo for helping with our transcripts and social media images, and Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Also, thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.